You're listening to Shtetl on the Shortwave on CKUT 90.3 FM. I'm your host, Tamara Kramer, and Shtetl is a Yiddish word that describes the towns of Eastern Europe where the Jews once lived. Shtetl on the Shortwave is a show about Jewish arts and culture in Montreal.
Du's Herz lässt dir, du's kennst die Kriegen.
Amma liegele,
apestramale,
a karnazale,
in a glazele wein.
In Rumänien ist doch geht, bin kein Geiges, weiß man nicht. Wein trinkt man überall, wenn verweist man Kaschtabau. Hey, digge, 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 digge.
Welcome to Shtetl on the Shortwave, and this week we're going to be focusing on some Jewish arts and culture happening down the road in Toronto. It's the 18th edition of the Jewish Film Festival in Toronto, and it's an incredible festival that they have lined up this year, and I really wanted to honor it because they have so many amazing feature films and documentaries, and it's happening all next week between the 17th and the 25th. And it's pretty incredible, the lineup that they have. So if you want to check that out and see what's going to be playing at the film festival, you can go to tjff.com. It's very simple. And there's so much happening there. And I know we have tons of listeners in Toronto and often Montrealers going over there. So if you have a chance to check out some of these movies, please do so. And we're going to highlight two of them today. We're going to be talking in the second half of the show with director Sam Ball. He has three movies in the festival this year. The main film that he's going to be showing is called Joanne Sfar Draws from Memory, and that's about the very prolific graphic novelist from France who's written and drawn many, many, many graphic novels, and amongst them is the Klezmer Trilogy and Le Chat du Rabbin, and he's also the director of the new film about Charles Gainsbourg, and Sam Ball's going to be on to talk about that and two of his other films at the festival. But first, we're going to be talking about The Jazz Baroness. It's directed by Hannah Rothschild, but before I tell you a bit about it, I'm going to give you a little introduction to who Hannah Rothschild and the Rothschilds are.
Good evening, everybody. This is Nika Stemper, and tonight we are coming to you direct from the Five Spot Cafe. And that beautiful music you hear is coming from Thelonious Monk and his quartet. Charlie Rouse on tenor saxophone, Roy Haynes on drums, and Ahmed Abdul Malik on bass. Thelonious Monk.
So in 1952, Panonica Rothschild heard for the first time Around Midnight by Thelonious Monk, and she completely fell in love with his music. She knew she had to meet him. And 2 years later, she did meet Thelonious Monk in Paris in 1954. And she ended up moving to New York and becoming a bit of a patron of the jazz scene there, not just for Thelonious Monk, but for many other musicians like Charlie Parker and others as well. And she comes from an incredible family, and I thought I might just give a little bit of a background, although most people probably know of the Rothschild family, known as the House of Rothschild. I just thought I'd let you know a little bit about where she's coming from. And we really get to see this in the movie, the extent of the wealth. So the Rothschilds are a European dynasty. They originated in Germany, and they established the European banking and finance houses from the late 1700s. There were five Austrian brothers in one of the branches of the Rothschild family, and they were all given hereditary baronies in the Habsburg Empire by the Emperor Francis II in 1816. And the British branch of the family was elevated into the nobility by Queen Victoria. That's the family that Panonica is from. And during the 19th century, the family possessed by far the largest private fortune in the world, and by far the largest fortune in modern history. And there's not, they're not 100% accurate records, but they say that at the height of their wealth in the mid-19th century, the Rothschild family had hundreds of billions, if not trillions of dollars. And this is the family that the Pannonica Rothschild is coming from. And the family's rise to European prominence began with Meir Amschel Rothschild. He was born in Frankfurt in 1744, and he was the son of a money changer born in the ghetto called Judengasse. I hope I'm pronouncing that right, Jew Alley in Frankfurt. And he developed a finance house and spread his empire by installing each of his five sons in European cities to conduct business. So in the film, The Jazz Baroness, we really get a glimpse of this woman. Her name is Kathleen Annie Pannonica Rothschild. She was born in 1913. She died in 1988. And the film is directed by, I think, her great niece, Hannah Rothschild, who was really curious to find out what her aunt did, why she felt like she wanted to leave this incredible life that she had in England. She left behind five children to go to New York to be a part of the jazz scene there. It's what she loved. She loved jazz music and she loved New York, and that's where she seemed to want to be. She was an incredible woman. She fought herself in World War II. She was not a woman to be taken lightly, and she cared so much for all the musicians, and she took care of them in many ways, sometimes financially, giving them a lot of different types of support. And she had a particularly special relationship with Thelonious Monk. She was a true believer in his genius. Although many were, there were times when they felt his music, critics and other musicians felt his music was too far out. And Pannonica never did. She always believed in him 100%. And even to the end of his life, when he was a bit sick, he lived with her for the last 10 years and she took care of him. She was always there for him and his family and for the other jazz musicians on the scene that she so adored being a part of. So today we're going to hear all about her relationship with Thelonious Monk, and we're going to hear about that from Thelonious's son, Thelonious Monk Jr., who we're going to talk to from New Jersey. But before we do, we're going to hear the song that Pannonica heard, which really changed her life. It's Around Midnight by Thelonious Monk. So that's Round Midnight by Thelonious Monk. And we've got on the line with us from New Jersey, Thelonious Monk's son, T.S. Monk, who is a great jazz musician in his own right. T.S., are you there?
I'm here tomorrow. How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine.
Thank you so much for coming on to the show. I wanted to ask you about your father's relationship with Panonica. Did you call her Panonica or did you call her?
No, Nika.
You called her Nika.
Yeah, everybody called her Nika. I think her dad and maybe her sisters and brothers called her Panonica. But once she got here, everybody called her Nika. You know, the jazz community is big on abbreviations and nicknames. So instantly they let the Panonica go and just said Nika.
Nika. So what was she like, Nika? Can I start by asking you that? She seems...
Sure. Well, you know, when I think back, I really don't remember when Nika wasn't, you know, part of the family. But I suppose, you know, I was 6 or 7 when I first met her. And Nika was as much fun as any young kid could possibly have. She was just a walking adventure. You know, I mean, from my earliest memories, you know, we'd get in the car in her Rolls Royce, and we'd just go somewhere. It was kind of amazing, you know, because she'd just say, come on, get in the car, we're going. And invariably, we would go to this, there was a pharmacy on the east side of Manhattan, in the Upper East Side, sold Polaroid film. Right.
Okay.
And Nika was probably the biggest advocate of Polaroid, the Polaroid Land camera that I ever knew. And so invariably we would go and buy literally buy like 50 rolls of Polaroid film. Right. And then we just start going places. It could be another club. You know, it would generally start out with us dropping my father off at the Vanguard. A lot of people, you know, think they were together all the time. Not at all. She would come pick him up. My mother would get him together. Nika would come pick him up, drop him at the Vanguard, and then take me and my sister on some kind of journey. Mm-hmm. Or it might be me and my sister, or it might be me and her daughter Yanka, or me and her daughter Curry. And we would just go, and we would go to musicians' houses. I mean, I have to tell you, and mm-hmm. I have to tell the public, that probably the greatest benefactor that jazz ever had was Panonica de Koningsbrugge, because I was there. I was there. We would go to the pawn shop to get somebody's horn out of the pawn shop for them. We would go and buy groceries and deliver them to some musician who I might not even know,
okay.
Who was broke and really needed food. We might stop by the hospital to see someone, or maybe we'd go to FAO Schwartz, which I have to tell you is still the greatest toy store in the world. But for a young African-American kid, it was an unbelievable place to go. And we'd go buy a present for someone's kids, or maybe she'd get something for me. And she was just a tremendous amount of fun. And the other thing that I really enjoyed about her was she was such an intellectual, and I sort of fancied myself as an intellectual very, very early on.
Okay.
So I was always looking to discuss things that were going on in the world, and she was always right there to do that. So she was just, as Nika would say, she was a gas.
Okay, so
absolutely.
It wasn't difficult to relate to somebody from such an incredibly wealthy dynasty. She was just like...
No, because she talked, you know, we talked about that a lot, as a matter of fact. When I think back in retrospect, you know, we talked often about, she told me, I knew where she grew up, I knew how she grew up, I knew about her father and her sisters, I knew some of the interior family conflicts that were going on. She used to tell me about growing up, you know, with her father, they would go to the Bank of England, and she would go down in the vault, and the guards would joke to her about, you know, if she could carry an ingot out, she could keep it, things like that. She told me, you know, she used to tell me these stories about currying supplies in Northern Africa with her husband during the war, and the Nazis, and the whole thing. So, you know, she really talked a lot about herself with me, and I guess it's perhaps in some ways it's easier to talk to a child about yourself than it is to talk to another adult, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Because my eyes were just like saucers, and I'm just listening to all this incredible information, and we might sit down on her bed sometimes, and she'd pull out this sort of jewelry chest that was absolutely ridiculous at the time. It just looked like a box of candy, and she would tell me the stories behind all these various pieces of jewelry, where this ring came from and this bracelet was given me to this one and by this one or that one, or talk about Einstein coming over for dinner. And she used to say it was always amazing because he would do a trick where he would remove his vest while he still had his jacket on. It was a trick he did for the kids, and they never knew
Einstein?
How he was able to do it. I guess it was something he learned from Houdini or something. But, you know, so she had, but the way she talked about it, there was a normalcy mm-hmm. about it when talking to me for some reason. And I think a lot of that had to do, when I think about it, had to do with the fact that she sort of considered me and my sister and my mother royalty of a certain kind, American royalty. And so mm-hmm. she discussed things with me that she might not have ordinarily discussed with other people or other children, for that matter, okay. you know. And she always, I mean, I felt from Nika is probably, you know, when you start talking to me about her, these things start coming back. Nika is probably the singular person that sort of illustrated to me how important artistically my father was, even more so than my mother, because that was mom and dad. And you know, my mother talked to my dad like wives talk to their husbands, you know, so she was talking about Thelonious get this or Thelonious take the garbage out, things right. that the general public would never think of. But Nika always talked about Thelonious in extraordinary terms, artistically. She always talked about his impact. She always talked about his influence. And I knew that she was, correct, because Thelonious was quick to correct you. Really quick to correct you, regardless of who you were talking. If you were lauding him and it was incorrect, he would correct you. So I knew that she would say these things about he and other artists when they were around, and I knew that it was all true. So it's a funny thing, because I didn't really discover who Thelonious was until I was about 19 years old and 4 years into becoming a musician myself, when it sort of hit me who this guy Thelonious Monk that everyone was talking about was. But Nika was very clear on that very, very early on. And I think because of her pedigree mm-hmm. and because of the great fortune that I had to have had a private education, and so I was a little bit worldly as any other kid going to private school in America in the 1960s. And so I knew who she was.
Okay.
And I knew her. I knew the way she and her culture viewed art.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was a much older culture. It was a much more in tune culture to art. And so when she spoke of these artisans, Thelonious being one, but the way she spoke of Miles or Bird or Coltrane or any of them, it had a different kind of impact than just, you know, maybe a teacher at school telling me, oh, you know, your father's an important musician or your father's a great musician. You know, so she was very, very, she was a learning experience 24/7. I mean, you know, Nika was to fandom, right, what Thelonious and Bird and Coltrane and Miles were to the art itself. Those are the greatest artisans. She was the greatest fan. You understand what I'm saying?
The number one fan. She did a lot for the jazz scene, right?
The number one fan, more than a Doris Duke, more than anyone you've ever heard who befriended jazz musicians. There was no one like Nika, because Nika also had, she didn't have any limitations on who she helped. You know, in other mm-hmm. words, she didn't say, well, let me help Charlie Parker because he's Charlie Parker, but I won't help John Jones because he's not Charlie Parker. You know?
Right.
Everybody was an equal opportunity artisan in her eyes, and she actually appreciated the effort, which is really what jazz is all about, because jazz is really about telling your story. So there's an inherent individual effort that goes on in jazz that's very in your face, but it's actually true for all artisans. And so we tend to celebrate events in an artist's life, but we tend here in America at this point still have not learned that you really judge an artist by the body of their work over time.
Mm-hmm.
That's when you really find out who someone is artistically. You know, someone can have a hit record, you know, a one-hit record, but would be one of the greatest songwriters that we've ever had. But they only had one hit record. We tend to judge that person by the hit record and not by the body of their work. And so we don't know who they are because they only had one hit and we forgot it.
Right.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And so Nika was the kind of, she was a champion for the arts, period. I think that if she had been attracted to sculpting, or had been attracted to oil painting, I think she would have approached it and its artisans with the same kind of fervor, because she really understood how much art is a part of who a person is. And that's why she treated everyone, understood that they were all artisans, whether you're Charlie Parker, John Coltrane, or, like I said, Jim Jones, living in the backwoods somewhere.
Thank God she loved jazz.
Yeah, thank you. We are very, very grateful, and it's been my joy to talk about her, because I think that Nika was much maligned in her early years. You know, I can tell you, for instance, that she had a lot of trouble in New York when Charlie Parker passed away in her apartment.
Why?
She had trouble from police.
Okay.
She had trouble in all kinds of places, because Charlie Parker, at that time, jazz was very popular. It was in boxes. He was a very popular figure. And she was somewhat viewed as sort of the femme fatale that had come into his life. But the reality is that at the point that Charlie Parker left us, he didn't have any friends. There were so few doors that he could knock on, none in New York, except for hers, and she let him in, and unfortunately he passed away in her home, and the natural spin, the exciting spin, the sexy spin, is that, the great Goliath taken down, or King Kong taken down by the damsel, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it was nothing like that at all. The relationship was nothing like that at all. Her relationship with all of the musicians was so rooted in the arts. I mean, it's hard to believe, but if you talk to any musician, and as evidenced in the video production, her in the highest regard, and they speak to her. They don't speak to of her as a sexual toy or as a girl. They talk about this great, great benefactor of the arts that understood. I mean, listen, them cats, they knew that she understood when a cat was swinging. I would hear Nika say, we'd go in some club, and she'd say, we've got to get out of here because they're not swinging at all, right? It would sound so odd coming out of this dyed-in-the-wool European woman. But you know what? When Nika said they weren't swinging, they were not swinging.
Right.
And so she knew the art form, and I think that that's what really, the fact that she was pretty, the fact that she was rich and royalty, that was the novelty that all the musicians enjoyed. That because, today rock and roll is like, would love to have, Prince, whoever, hang out.
Right.
But when they say, come over the house, we're going to a jam session, you come along with us. When they say that kind of thing, that stuff is only reserved for the people that they hold, for the fans that they hold in the highest regard.
T.S., can I ask you a question about, I don't know if this is something that you'd want to talk about, but
I talk about everything.
Everything. Okay, great. I'm curious because your father was married and he had a couple of children, and mm-hmm. I wonder, was there ever talk that his relationship with Panonica or Nika was that they were lovers, or were they just really good friends?
Let me lay it out for you. I'm glad you asked that question.
Okay.
because one of my roles since my father was not a man of many words. As you can see, I am a man of many words. but as a result of that, I found that I have been very instrumental in explaining a lot of what Thelonious was about.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's something that's always in the air. That's the 800-pound gorilla in the room for the relationship between Thelonious and Nika. So let me lay it out to you as I saw it, okay?
Okay.
Regardless of the video, regardless of books, regardless of whatever, this is how I saw it. My father went to Europe, and his music got around. Nika heard the music. Nika said, I got to meet this guy, okay?
Mm-hmm.
She met my father. My father was charming, good-looking, on top of his stuff, he was a cat that a lot of women said, oh, yeah, that's the low, and with that name, I like that guy.
Mm-hmm.
Thelonious was laser-locked into Nelly. Nika, right, sought Thelonious out, became his friend. I'm 60 years old now, so I ain't no kid. I know how the world works, and I know how life works. So I have no doubt that she was very, very fond of my father. I have no doubt that had he been predisposed to a more intimate relationship, she would have rolled with that in a minute.
Mm-hmm.
But this is what happened. She met my mother. She met me and my sister. She realized that Thelonious was laser locked into Nelly. And this is what makes Nika so fantastic.
Nelly was your mother.
Huh?
Nelly is your mother.
Nelly is my mother.
Okay.
Nika realized that this guy was everything he seemed to be. And everybody knew that it was about Thelonious and Nelly. And she saw it. So Nika, actually, her intimate relationships were with people like Art Blakey and a number of other musicians. But with Thelonious, she realized, you know, let me ask you, Tamara, have you ever had a situation where you meet somebody you really, really like? You might have met a guy that, oh, man, this guy is the bomb. But this guy has got a girlfriend that he's really locked into. But he's still really cool, and so is she. And you become really, really good friends, great friends. And 20 years later, 20 years out of high school, you say, boy, we could have really had something going. But we're still great friends. You know, that's what happened with the three of them. It became a three musketeer thing. You see, because of Nika's understanding of art,
mm-hmm.
and she's looking at Thelonious living in this tiny little two-bedroom apartment, right, with a wife and two kids. And it's obvious that Thelonious is a very, very high-maintenance individual, but he and Nelly have managed to get it done.
Mm-hmm.
She decided, and I know she decided in her head, and I'm sure this was a tough decision, but she decided that I want to know this guy, and I want to know this family. And if I have to just know them, that's what I will do. And so by the time I was 8 or 9 years old,
mm-hmm.
I looked at them like three musketeers.
Mm-hmm.
Me, myself, my mother, Nika, my father, maybe Sonny Clark, piano player, maybe Hank Mobley, great tenor player, plus Yonka, her daughter, Barrett, her daughter, Curry, her daughter. All of us spent a good 7 or 8 Christmas together.
Okay.
As one big, giant family, right? Mm-hmm. And something that people don't know because it's written, you know, people have read that, well, the last, you know, 10 years of Thelonious Monk's life, he lived out in New Jersey at the Baroness residence. What, but to see, that's very sexy, you know? Oh, he went to her house. What they don't say is that my mother became an expert in holistic medicine,
okay.
particularly in vegetable juicing, that kind of thing, way before the curve.
Mm-hmm.
It's crazy now. In 1963, my mother was going up to Hunts Point Market here in New York, which is where all the stores buy their vegetables, and buying 500 pounds of carrots, right, to juice them. Hand on her $10,000 carrot press machine,
whoa.
This kind of thing, you know? And so my mother and father were actually living at Nika's for the last 10 years of his life.
Oh, really?
Absolutely. But Nelly was going back and forth to New York because it was New York where she prepared all these vegetable juices and things that she brought to Thelonious.
Oh, I see.
You see? So mm-hmm. people don't know that part of the story.
They all lived together.
Like, took off and went to New Jersey. Hell no.
Okay.
No, it was such a team effort. It was unbelievable to keep this guy they did quite a job of it, and everybody knew their role. And Nika had her private personal relationships with a number of musicians, you know, some that I know of, I'm sure some that I don't know of, you know. But there was, and the family, If you go around and ask the Monk family or the Smith family, which is my mother's side, there's about 500 Monks and about 300 Smiths, and you ask any of us, and Thelonious had a whole host of nieces and nephews because he had a brother and a sister, and Nellie had a brother and a sister, and they all had kids, right?
Mm-hmm.
And all the kids hung around Thelonious all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you ask anybody, they'll tell you the same thing I did. Everybody saw it. Of course, listen, I'm an African-American, right? And like I said, I'm 60 years old. Now, you know that back in the late 1950s and 1960s, early 1960s, if you have a family, a nuclear family situation, and another woman shows up, you take notice.
Right.
If the other woman is white, you really take notice. You know?
Yeah.
So everybody was looking all the time. If this is not, you know, do not think that the family was in a fog
mm-hmm.
about this relationship. Everybody was looking all the time. They became such pals on so many levels and helped each other in so many, many ways. You know, I think that something that people don't talk about and don't really know about is what Thelonious did for Nika.
What did he do for
her? In terms of, you have to remember, here's this woman who's born into the seat of royalty and luxury and European history, right? And she threw it all away, in a sense. You know, when she left, the family sort of didn't disown her, but they did everything short of disowning her. And everybody was not, you can't imagine that you're talking about a very private family, the Rothschild family, and all of a sudden you have this one daughter who's having a very public life, and not only is it in America, with African-American men to which she's not married, you know, so that didn't please anyone. And when someone does that kind of thing, regardless of how strong you are as an individual, you need a support team around you to tell you you made the right decision, that everything's going to be okay, that you are who you are. And, you know, the same things that Thelonious did for a John Coltrane and a Miles Davis and a Bud Powell as a mentor, he did for Nika. Mm-hmm. It's just that she wasn't playing the same instrument. But the emotions and all of that stuff that an artisan like Thelonious gives to those around him, he gave to her too.
Okay.
You know, and that helped her have the strength to do what she was doing. You know, when you start doing these things, if you don't have someone like a Thelonious Monk saying, hey, you're doing the right thing by going and getting that cat's horn for him, if you can do that. That's a great thing to do, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it was a two-way relationship, as all relationships are two-way.
It sounds like a very special relationship
It was a very, very special relationship, and I have to tell you, you know, when Thelonious had episodes when he was hospitalized, all of us visited him every day. There were lots of times, and I know there were times in the early years, you know, where there was financial help that that Nika gave to my mom, because, you know, Thelonious, you know, you have to remember, Thelonious had his cabaret card taken away, so he couldn't work in New York for a long time. I remember when my mother was working two jobs. She might have been working two jobs when Nika first showed up on the scene.
Right.
And Thelonious was just, you know, and she, Nelly, understood that this guy had to stay home and write this music because he was writing some great music, and she believed in him.
Mm-hmm.
And Nika came along, and she believed in him at a very trying time in his life. So when I look back at the sacrifice, the emotional sacrifice made by both Nelly and Nika for Thelonious, I just say, boy, this was a hell of a guy, and it really required a team effort to keep him out of the kind of sordid imagery that could have befallen him had he not had Nelly and Nika around him.
Okay. T.S., I'm going to ask you one last question, which is sort of a little bit on a different subject, and maybe there's not much to say on it, but I'd be curious to know. I think that your father came from a Baptist family, is that correct?
Yeah.
And Nika was obviously from a Jewish family. Was her Jewishness at all a part of who she was, or was that also something that she left behind?
Oh, she was very Jewish. Are you kidding? Nika celebrated all the Jewish holidays, and, you know, went to the synagogue when she could, and had I forget the little scroll that's on your front door.
A mezuzah?
On the front door, absolutely, absolutely. But that was no problem. A, because she was in America, and Thelonious was a real American, and she became a real American. And so there was no problem in having different religious backgrounds. But above and beyond that, if one actually looks at the relationship between the Jewish community and the African-American community, particularly in the northeast of this country, the little Jaime Town bit with Jesse Jackson a couple of decades ago, notwithstanding, it has been a marvelous, marvelous relationship. Whether you go back to Woody Herman bringing Lionel Hampton into the band and into the first integration of entertainment in this country, or you talk about all of the great Jewish activists that went down south and rode in on the buses in with the Freedom Riders in Selma. You know, I mean, the list goes on and on and on of a relationship that has been very, very healthy and mutually beneficial for both groups over the years. So that, you know, when you overlay that on top of the fact neither of these people had any tendency to hold anything against anybody for being who they were, because that's a great part of what jazz is, be who you are. There was no problem at all, you know, and I learned a lot about being Jewish from being around Nika. You know, that's why, you know, I know about mezuzahs and menorahs, and, you know, I can sing Hava Negila and all that stuff. I know the deal, because we were all very, very open about who we were. And actually, Thelonious was brought up as a Baptist, but then you have to remember that Thelonious's mother converted to Jehovah's Witness.
Okay.
So now we got Mama, who's a Jehovah's Witness. Thelonious is a Baptist. Nika, who's a Jew. I mean, come on. You're talking America big time.
It's the United Nations right there in your neighborhood.
Exactly.
All right. T.S., I want to let people also know about where they could maybe hear your music. Do you think you might ever come to the Jazz Festival here in Montreal?
I've been.
You've been?
A couple
okay.
of times.
Okay.
And I would suspect I will be back again. I must actually. I've had great, great success and a lot of fun in Canada. You know, I've played the Montreal Festival and the festival and, oh, God.
Toronto?
Toronto, and the festival in Saskatoon.
Okay.
And I've been out to B.C., and, you know, I've been in a whole bunch of little towns that I didn't even know existed, you know, because people tend to go from Montreal all the way over to the other side and forget what's happening in the middle and up in Quebec. But, you know, I've had the opportunity to do that, and Canada has been very, very, very good to me, and Canada has contributed some absolutely fantastic jazz musicians to the pantheon of greats in jazz. So I will definitely be back to Canada, and hopefully, you know, I have to say that the festival in Montreal is absolutely fabulous, you know, and when you combine that with the fact that Montreal seems to be the cleanest city on the North American continent, it's a groove for me, so
okay.
I will definitely be back.
Well, we'd love to have you, and I'm so glad that you came on Shtetl on the Shortwave. Thank you, T.S.
Thank you, Tamar. You have a great day.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye.
So that was T.S., Thelonious Monk Jr., talking about his father's relationship with Nika Rothschild, and you can find out all about that relationship in the beautiful movie that her niece made called The Jazz Baroness, and that's going to be playing this week at the Toronto Jewish Film Festival. And before we go to our next guest, we're going to hear a little bit from Thelonious Monk. It's a song called Panonica off of his album Brilliant Corners.
Der Herzach zi Shtetl auf in Shortwave auf CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal.
All right, so we're back on Shtetl on the shortwave. And I hadn't mentioned that part of the Toronto Jewish Film Festival is that they're highlighting, and every year they have a special theme that they highlight. And this year it's the role of Jewish people in the comic book world, the people of the comic book, they call it. And in keeping with that, we're going to be talking right now with Sam Ball, the director of Joanne Sfar Draws from Memory. And as I mentioned at the beginning, Joanne Sfar was born in Nice in 1971, and he is a graphic novelist who wrote and drew The Rabbi's Cat, the Klezmer Trilogy, and many others. And he's also the director of the Gainsbourg biopic. And Sam Ball has a couple of films in the festival this year, and he's on the line with us right now from San Francisco. Sam, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Good morning.
Welcome to Good Morning. I know it's pretty early there, so I really appreciate you coming on to the show.
Sure. It's 9 o'clock already. We're burning daylight already here out on the West Coast.
All right. Well, maybe it's early for me. So, Sam, I wanted to ask you about the movies that you had in the film festival. Can you tell me first about the Joanne Sfar Draws from Memory?
Sure. It's a portrait of Joanne Sfar. And a lot of the work we do here at Citizen Film is portrait work, documentary portraits, often of artists.
Mm-hmm.
And Joanne is certainly the most prolific graphic novelist in France's New Wave, and maybe the most prolific graphic novelist ever. I think he's published 150 books. And what's interesting about him is those books are incredibly diverse in style, in form, in story, and his best-known book, of course, is The Rabbi's Cat, which rose to the top of France's bestseller list in 2007, ahead of any book of any genre, which is absolutely sensational for a comic book. But in addition to that, French readers will know his comic book diaries, which are these memoiristic pages that he writes almost every day, just chronicling that day's event or that day's sequence of events in his own life.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's some of the most exceptional work he does. He's published about 5,000 pages of these autobiographical or memoiristic comic books to date. So we drew heavily, we relied heavily on those diaries in the documentary. And for English-speaking audiences, that will be the first time that they've had access to those pages, which are really some of the most exciting things going on in contemporary graphic novels.
Did you get a lot of time spent with Joanne Sfar?
We did. We conducted several hours of interviews, and we had a number of shooting days at his home in Paris and in various locations throughout Paris. I think one of the things that happened over the course of our shooting period is Joanne became extremely famous.
Mm-hmm.
So as I mentioned, the book rising to the top of the bestseller list was the beginning of a snowball. And shortly after that, he received commissions, one commission to do the Serge Gainsbourg biopic, which of course is a huge deal in France, as you might imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And on the heels of that, he's directing an animated version of The Rabbi's Cat.
So, oh, really?
So sort of midway through our shooting period, we started working with a celebrity, which of course poses its own challenges in terms of access.
Okay. Did he remain a nice guy even though he became such a celebrity? Is he a nice guy, Joanne Sfar? You've got the inside scoop.
Is Joanne Sfar a nice guy? Yes, I think he is a nice guy. I think he's very personable.
Yeah.
And I think that comes across in the film. I think he's also very reserved, and I think that's always a challenge as a portraitist, is how do you do something that's true and authentic to the person, or at least what you want to show of that person's experience, and walk the line between giving the viewer access and respecting the intimacy of the subject.
Mm-hmm.
So that's always a challenge, probably for any documentary filmmaker, but particularly in a film where there's one voice and one subject, one person, one character.
So I want to ask you about the other movies that you have at the festival. You said you have The Balancing Acts and Pleasures of Urban Decay. Can you tell me a bit about those? Because they also sound really fascinating as well and related.
Sure. Since we're on the subject of the people of the comic book, Pleasures of Urban Decay is a portrait of another great Jewish graphic novelist named Ben Katcher. And Ben is at another end of the spectrum from Joanne. His comic books are not autobiographical in any way. And Ben is just a brilliant person, and if there's a genius, if there's such a thing, then I think Ben is a genius. He has a way of seeing particularly urban landscapes and the whole and of understanding the city as a living organism, the way I think few people bring those kinds of insights from people. I mean, I've done a lot of reading of people who are interested in urban planning and urban planners and social scientists, and Ben really just stands out for the way he understands cities and the way he can talk about them. You see things in a new way when you read and look at Ben's work.
And he'll be at the festival speaking, actually, right? As will you. You're also going to be coming into Toronto for the festival?
Yes, that's right. I'm looking forward to that. And I know Ben's looking forward to that as well.
And what about the last one? Also sounds really interesting. I'd love to see this, The Balancing Act.
Yeah, and the third film we're showing at the Toronto Jewish Film Festival is called Balancing Acts. And it's also a portrait of an artist, although it's an artist who's no longer with us. His name was Solomon Michoels. And he was the director of an avant-garde Yiddish theater in Moscow during the first heady days of the Soviet Union, when artistic experimentation was still possible. And the theater that he founded, along with a man named Alexander Granovsky, is probably best known today for the fact that Marc Chagall did all its sets in the early years.
Wow.
So the film is about this magical moment when these three very brilliant artists from different fields came together to create a theater. Michoels was an actor by trade. Granovsky was a theater director. And, of course, Chagall was already Chagall. Mm-hmm. But this is the young Chagall, and there are many Chagall historians who say that, this would be a caricature of what they say, but I think there's some truth to it. All of the work that Chagall did subsequent to his collaborations with Gosset are kind of a footnote. He really became Chagall through his collaboration with the theater. All of the themes that you find in Chagall's work in the span of his lifetime as an artist were being worked out in these first few years when he was drawing these giant theater sets with all of his famous characters being worked out for an audience. And the Russians that I've talked to all know about this theater. It was not just a great Jewish theater, but most of the audience after a certain point consisted of people who were just Russian. And it was on the main street with all of the other theaters in Moscow when theater was Russia's national pastime, mm-hmm. or the Soviet Union's national pastime. And because these sets became a sensation, people would line up during the day. They began selling tickets for people just to come in and look at Chagall's sets before the shows began. There'd be lines around the block, and people would go and look at Chagall's sets and then come back for the theater show later that night.
Okay. Sam, it sounds like you have one of the most interesting jobs on earth, making all these amazing...
It is pretty interesting. I can't complain. Yeah.
Wow.
I could complain, but who would listen?
Okay, you have like 30 seconds. Complain away. No, it's okay. I would totally listen. I'm very curious to hear about your work. And I went onto the site, your production company, Citizen Film, and it looks like, in addition to the work that you do on Jewish artists, that you have a lot of other really incredible movies. So hopefully I know you said that your site is under construction, but if people want to check out the other films, it's citizenfilm.com. Is that right?
It's actually citizenfilm.org.
Citizenfilm.org.
And I would say about half our work is up there now. We're in the midst of a relaunch that will happen in June. So
I think
visit
it's,
now and then come back in a couple months and you'll see.
It's definitely worth it for people to check it out because there's a lot of really interesting films up there in addition to the ones we talked about today. Sam, thank you for coming on Shtetl on the Shortwave.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, good luck at the festival. So that was Sam Ball, the director of Joanne Svarr Draws from Memory and the other films he mentioned, Balancing Acts and Pleasures of Urban Decay. And as you can tell, those were just two of many, many films at the festival. There's a lot of incredible stuff going on. And even just going on the website, if it should happen that you're not listening from Toronto or that you're not going there this week, just going on the website and seeing all that's there is interesting in itself. It's tjff.com. And happening in Montreal this week is the Montreal Israeli Film Festival. If you're interested in getting tickets for that, it's a much smaller festival, but there's some great movies, including Ajami, the movie that was nominated for the Best Foreign Film at the Academy Awards this year, another Israeli film nominated in that category, and a movie that I saw called Eyes Wide Open. Very interesting. It's sort of like... it's the story of two Hasidic men in Mea Shearim, a very Orthodox community in Jerusalem, and who have a very special relationship with one another. It's sort of a little bit like Brokeback Mountain in Jerusalem, if that gives you an idea. Anyways, check it out. To go to the festival and to get tickets, it's 514-937-2332. Or you can go to www.israelfilmfestival.ca and see what's playing. And one last announcement. Coming up on Sunday, April 25th, the Michael Winograd Klezmer Trio is going to be here in Montreal with special guest accordion master Sergio Popa. I'm really not sure if I'm saying that right.
Sergio Popa,
as says Katie Moore, the wonderful, amazing technician. How did you pronounce it?
Sergio Popa.
He'll be playing with Michael Winograd, who is a bit of a clarinet virtuoso. So it's definitely worth checking out that Sunday, April 25th at the Accentris on Saint Laurent Boulevard. And just in the studio, we have Butcher T, because any moment now it's going to be Butcher T's noontime cut. So stay tuned for that. And we're going to go out with a song by Charlie Parker called Out of Nowhere. And Charlie Parker was another one of Nika Rothschild's friends in New York, and somebody that she supported even to the end of his life. He also spent time living with her. And she's got a really interesting story. So if you want to check that out, it's the Jazz Baroness of the Toronto Jewish Film Festival. This is Out of Nowhere by Charlie Parker.